Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. First and most obvious thing is get out of the way of this storm if you're in its path. The question for a whole lot of people, though, is how to do that. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is Wednesday, today the 12th of September. Glad, as always, to have you with us, everybody. One hopes that whatever portion of the population of North and South Carolina and Virginia that is listening to this program in their cars is listening as they drive away from low ground. Hurricane Florence is going to be on shore in a day or less. Those who aren't gone already are, again, one hopes, packing up their cars, their families, their possessions, and heading west. But not everybody's got or can afford a car of their own to get out. So what does evacuation look like if you're in the danger zone and don't have a set of wheels? Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has that one.
80-foot waves were crashing off the coast of Myrtle Beach, South Carolina this afternoon, and buses were wrapping up free evacuations before time ran out, transporting local residents, foreign students, tourists.
And in addition to that, you had our seasonal workers, H-2Bs, who were in town for the season to work at hotels and in the hospitality industry.
Michelle Canty of the Coast Regional Transport Authority was in her car making another run between her agency and a shelter. A mandatory evacuation presents tough choices for everyone. What to take, what to leave. But when you don't have a car and you're on the bus,
limit it to basically what you can fit in the seat with you. So it's a bag or a couple of small bags.
Moving people out of the Myrtle Beach area will cost the transit agency about $20,000, and it's just a small part of the evacuation zone. There are about 400,000 households without cars in the overall danger zone, says Diane Yentel of the National Low-Income Housing Coalition. Many of them are low-income.
You know, evacuations can be expensive. If shelters are full, it can mean needing money for a motel room.
A recent survey from the Department of Housing and Urban Development found less than 40% of renters and 12% of homeowners had access to the money they might need to evacuate in an emergency. But Yentel points out the timing of this storm might give some relief.
You know, at this time in the month, people that are living paycheck to paycheck may still have a little of one of those paychecks unspent
to cover the costs of evacuation. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
There is regulatory news of note today. The Food and Drug Administration has announced that it's cracking down on flavored e-cigarettes. It's given five big e-cigarette makers 2 months to draw up plans to stop underage use of their products or have those products pulled off store shelves. Products that, it should be said, bring in $2.5 billion a year. Marketplace's Justin Ho has that one.
Addison Deck is 21. He works two jobs in Mansfield, Connecticut, one at Starbucks, the other at a pizza chain called Blaze Pizza. His shifts can run long, and when he can, he likes to go outside with his e-cigarette of choice, a Vupu Drag.
The visuals of smoke I just find so relaxing and satisfying.
He started vaping because he wanted to stop smoking regular cigarettes. Marlboro was his brand. He switched to a small e-cigarette called Juul. It still contains nicotine but uses flavored pods with tastes like mango and cool cucumber.
I like a lot of the fruitier flavors, which is funny because I smoked like Marlboros.
A recent Wells Fargo report says that Juul has captured 72% of the e-cigarette market. And the FDA says the number of teenagers using e-cigarettes has reached an epidemic proportion. Desmond Jensen at the Public Health Law Center says when many teens think of e-cigarettes, they don't really think about the nicotine.
An overwhelming majority will tell you it's for the flavors.
He says teens are also lured by e-cigarettes' social media presence. Juul Labs says it intends to work with the FDA to prevent underage use. And Thomas Kicklis, president of the Tobacco Vapor Electronic Cigarette Association, says tobacco stores also have good reason to keep minors out.
You know, that tobacco license is awfully valuable.
But he says the FDA's focus on flavored e-cigarettes could make it harder for adults who are trying to quit regular cigarettes. And easier for the tobacco companies, who'd lose one big source of competition. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
In San Francisco today, something called the Global Climate Action Summit got going. 4,000 political and business leaders, scientists, and activists trying to highlight successful approaches to tackling carbon emissions. Successful being a key word there because humanity's collective track record on that is not great. A carbon tax is one idea, not an uncontroversial one, and it does divide people mostly along party lines. Mostly, but not entirely. Republican Congressman Carlos Curbelo of Florida introduced a bill back in July that would put a carbon tax in place. He signed up two GOP co-sponsors. So from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Jed Kim reports now on the prospects of that bill actually happening.
The push for a carbon tax isn't new. Democrats have tried for years, but they've never gotten far with their Republican counterparts. That's why Christina DeConcini of the World Resources Institute is excited about the recent bill from Carlos Curbelo.
Because it's been more than 10 years that there's been Republicans in Congress really stepping forward in positive ways on climate change.
And she says business leaders, including ones from BP, Dow Chemical, and Unilever, have signaled interest in discussing a tax. Still, she says it's not likely to come up for a vote as is. Republican leadership is firmly against a carbon tax, and the majority of Republican House members recently voted for a non-binding resolution saying it's a bad idea. Myron Ebell of the Competitive Enterprise Institute led the Trump administration's EPA transition team.
The Curbelo bill isn't going anywhere, and some of the people who are foolish enough to support it are likely to be defeated at the next election.
But the politics aren't that clear-cut, according to Noah Kaufman, who directs Columbia University's Carbon Tax Research Institute.
You know, there are definitely Republican congressmen who are very uncomfortable with the idea of being the party that does not want to look for solutions on climate change. So I think that's the reason why you're seeing some movement.
Republicans are facing a tough midterm overall, and what happens in November could shape discussions to come. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
Wall Street today was a bit meh, honestly, until word of a new round of China trade negotiations leaked. Then traders were happy. Then they got a little meh again. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Ten years ago this week, Lehman Week, as we've been reminding you, a guy by the name of Michael Ozinski was far away from Wall Street tending his family's oyster farm out on Long Island. But a software program that he had written years before to help banks securitize mortgages, that is, slice them up and sell them off, was a big part of why the collapsing housing market did the economic damage it did. So for this next installment of our series, How We Changed, we're going to hear from Michael Ozinski at his farm in Greenport, New York.
1985, I came to New York, you know, to see the big city. Everything in Wall Street was then becoming automated, so eventually got a job at Lehman Brothers, and I eventually wrote what's called a structuring tool for them. That's the piece of software that takes bundles of mortgages and can make mortgage-backed securities. You take chicken, you put it into the grinder, and out comes sirloin, and that's what mortgage-backed securities are. There was a lot of irresponsible lending. No one was really checking because everyone was making money off of us. There were some people that had some negative, very negative views about us. Most people realize that, you know, we wrote a good piece of software that we sold in the marketplace. How people use that software, you really can't control that. But I had a hard time explaining how I could retire at 40, so we came out here, we were relatively well off, and we discovered by accident that we own 5 acres underwater here. My wife said, you know, why don't you learn how to grow oysters, and we can do this, and it would be a good thing to raise the kids. So we own a family oyster farm. My wife, my 2 kids, and I farm oysters here in Greenport, and we have for the last 18 years. The only similarity that I can see about working on Wall Street and the oyster farm is that, well, we sell 90% or 95% of our crop in Manhattan. So instead of dealing with the egos of bond traders, I'm dealing with the egos of famous chefs. You know, I think the chefs know more about hospitality. I think they treat people a little bit nicer than your average bond trader.
Mm-hmm.
can see a video of Michael Osinski, including his oyster farm, by the way, on our YouTube channel. We're at Marketplace APM. Subscribe while you're at it. A couple of months ago, I got a package in the mail. No return address, a note inside that said maybe I'd know what to do with the contents, which I didn't until now. It was complete editions of the Wall Street Journal from this week in 2008. The paper of September 12th was the first one in the stack, and the headline in the top right corner was Lehman Races to Find a Buyer. Lehman at that point had about 2.5 days left. Bankruptcy came on the 15th, 10 years ago this Saturday. Back in March, I did a sit-down with Hank Paulson, Tim Geithner, and Ben Bernanke, the big three, we call them around here, to get their recollections of that week and how they think back about the crisis. We're going to play just a bit of that interview now. The setup here is that we'd been talking about how, try though they did, they just weren't able to convince the public of A, how bad things were, but also B, why, after Lehman failed, the big banks had to be bailed out. Here you go. But to that point, Tim, you actually say in the book, and you said since, you know, we saved the economy, but we lost the country, right? And you three specifically went out there and were saying reassuring things because you kind of had to, because had you said the truth, it would have been catastrophic. But I wonder if it would have been easier for you to do your jobs had the public been more informed about the reality and more aware of their economy. You're not. So
yeah, well, that's it would have been, but the challenge, and this is, of all the things, I think when we've talked about it, all three of us wish that we could have done a better job of communicating. I look at it, and I look and say, you know, I really wish I was able to help the American people understand that what we were doing wasn't for Wall Street. It was to protect the financial system for them.
And but Hank, but wait, because every time you went up to Congress, people in Congress, the Democrats usually would say, we need mortgage relief and we need to help everybody. And you led the charge in, we have to save Wall Street, full stop.
So
make that connection for me.
Yeah, so here's a connection I will make, okay? If I had to decide, was forced to decide between reassuring the markets and having market stability, okay, and telling the public what they wanted to hear, I opted on market stability because I thought that was protecting the public. And I really did. And so the fact was, I wish I could have done a better job of both. The public wanted to, and understandably wanted to see the banks punished, okay? Yeah. And I understand why. They wanted to see the banks be held accountable. But we did something that was very novel, worked very well economically, and was politically a disaster. We designed a system that let us move at lightning speed, recapitalize 700 banks. But if we'd put conditions on that capital,
right,
we put conditions on it, banks wouldn't have taken that capital until they were getting ready to fail.
Tim, go ahead.
I mean, I was going to say this is the central dilemma for policymakers in a crisis, which is that everybody's instinct is to let the thing burn.
Yeah.
Because it seems just to let it burn. And it seems fair, good for future incentives, good for moral hazard, better at preventing future crises. But if you let the thing burn to the point the system collapses, you're going to be left with hundreds of millions of innocent victims. And it is very hard for people to understand, completely understandably, that what feels unjust and immoral in the context of breaking a panic is the most just thing to do if your interest is trying to prevent the economy from mass unemployment or a decade of breadlines across the country like what happened in the Great Depression. And it's a hard thing for people to appreciate, I think, in part because, you know, we hadn't had a major financial panic in 75 years. There was no living memory of what the risks were in letting a panic burn go too far. And in some ways, it's the central reason why these things are so terrible, because the natural human political instinct around fairness and justice collides with what is necessary and effective to protect the most people.
We'll put the whole interview with the Big Three in the Marketplace podcast feed, or you can get it at marketplace.org. Coming up.
They want to raise kids who will contribute to a fair and just society, but at the same time, they want to give their kids opportunities.
And between the two, there are some trade-offs. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 27 points today, a 10%, 25,998. The NASDAQ down 18 points, 0.2%, 7,954. S&P 500 basically flat, 2,888. Apple wilted 1.2% today. The company, as you might have heard, gosh, somewhere, I don't know, just unveiled three new iPhones against a background of slowing mobile phone sales. Google parent Alphabet, which maintains the Android operating system, powered down 1.5%. Motorola down 0.1% today. The Food and Drug Administration's threat to pull some e-cigarettes from the market pushed traditional cigarette makers higher because, of course, Altria fired up 6.6%, Philip Morris up 0.4%, British American Tobacco rolled up 5.8% today. Bond prices up, yield on the 10-year T-note down to 2.96%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. A new anti-tariff group is making some noise today. Tariffs hurt the heartland is what they call themselves. Trade groups and businesses from the tech sector to Apple farms trying to get some traction with Congress. Sam Desai is trying to get some traction, too. We've talked to him a couple of times. He's the vice president of RM Metals in South Plainfield, New Jersey. Wanted to get him on earlier this week, in fact, but he was overseas exploring his steel sourcing options. Sam, it's good to talk to you again.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. So listen, it's been a little bit. There's been much tariff news since we talked to you last. How's business? How's it going?
Business was good, and then it's getting tougher as we speak. It's just a lot of uncertainty. Customers are really worried about what the next round of duties or tariffs will bring about.
Are you able to pass those costs on, or are you eating them?
We have ate many of them. We have tried to pass them down 100%, and it doesn't work. And therefore, business has become less.
When you say it doesn't work, are people just saying, no thanks, I don't want it, or and then going somewhere else? Is that the deal?
Some have accepted it. Others have said no thanks and moved on to domestic purchasing.
Huh.
And others are worried about maybe the tariff going even higher.
Yeah, which has, of course, been threatened. I understand you're just back from overseas. You went over to Asia to look around for new suppliers, I guess, from non-tariffed countries?
No, actually, I think all countries in Asia are under the tariff. I just went to go and meet some of the ones I generally buy from.
And what are they saying?
They feel that the establishment, the U.S., has become very tough, and it seems like they feel that it's going to block business in the future.
So what are you going to do, Sam? I mean, seriously.
Seriously, tell you, we're not sure. I mean, it seems like the business has just reduced, and it's continuing to reduce down further. I mean, all the countries want to take retaliatory actions, and just it's just not the best environment anymore to do business.
I got to tell you, Sam, even though you did just get off a plane from Asia yesterday, you sound tired, man.
I'm tired, not just mentally. I think physically I'm a little tired, but mentally more tired, you know, just to talk about the duty every day since March 8th has been tough.
Sam Desai, he's the vice president of RM Metals in South Plainfield, New Jersey. Sam, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
No problem. Thank you very much.
When we talk about race and racism in this economy, the experiences we most often hear about are the experiences of the people who've been marginalized, the people who've been shut out, or worse. Less common is studying the people with the power and the money and the privilege. Sociologist Margaret Hagerman from Mississippi State University spent 2 years observing and hanging out with affluent white kids and their parents. Those parents all own homes and have advanced degrees, and they live, Hagerman writes in her new book, which is called White Kids, they live in predominantly white neighborhoods in a shall-remain-nameless Midwestern suburb. Margaret, thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Give me the opening anecdote in this book, Edward and you driving through McDonald's, would you?
Sure. So it's snowing, and Edward and I are driving through the McDonald's, and he is, you know, coming home from hockey practice, and he's really hungry. And so we just go to whatever McDonald's is closest, because I don't really know all the different McDonald's.
Yeah. And he's like 12, right? Isn't that the deal?
Correct. He's 12 years old. And I notice that he is looking out the window, and he's noticing a group of black children getting off the school bus. And the kids are doing the things that he does every day with his friends, like have a snowball fight in this case. And he says, oh, we're not in a very good neighborhood, are we, Maggie? And I was really struck by that because, you know, the kids were literally having a snowball fight. They were laughing, joking around. And it was this powerful moment for me where I was really able to see how children are making sense of the world around them on their own. They're interpreting their environment. And he then went on to tell me that his mom had told him at one point that that neighborhood was not a very good neighborhood. And she would certainly know because she's his mom. So.
And then the kicker to this anecdote is that just a couple of days before this, hadn't Edward said to you, race doesn't matter anymore? Or something, right?
Right. He told me that racism is not a problem and that race doesn't matter in America.
Talk to me about this thing you call the conundrum of privilege, would you?
Sure. So parents who are identifying as anti-racist and identifying as people who really care about equity and justice, how they are simultaneously giving advantages to their kids. And because the families in this study have this economic privilege, they really are able to craft whatever context of childhood they want for their kids. And so the conundrum comes in because they want to raise kids who will contribute to a fair and just society, but at the same time, they want to give their kids opportunities so that their children can be successful and can thrive and can potentially get into Harvard and so on. Mm-hmm. And so I think that these parents really are trying to be on the one hand a good citizen, but on the other hand, you know, sort of adhering to this idea of what it means to be a good parent, which means for many people giving their children everything they can.
But if I give my kids everything I can, which full disclosure here, I tried to do, well, I don't know if it necessarily comes at the expense of another child, but it in a very sort of poetic kind of sense, it kind of does, right?
Yeah, so I've gotten a lot of questions about this, and I think a good example might be the following. So if you have a child that's in a classroom and your kid comes home from school and is complaining about the teacher and complaining about the classroom and there's dynamics in there that you're not happy with as a parent, and you're someone who has a lot of power and privilege in your community, you have a choice to either go to the principal and demand that your child is removed from that classroom, or go to the principal and demand that they fix whatever situation is going on in that classroom. And those are two different choices. And so I'm certainly not advocating for people not caring about their kids or not supporting their own children, but I think there are moments where people in positions of power could make slightly different decisions that would have meaningful consequences for their own kid, but also for other kids.
But that's a whole series of micro level decisions that parents are making in a really, really complicated macro level societal problem.
Absolutely. I think that the parents in my study really struggle, even though they think of themselves as having really good intentions, because they live in a society that's unequal. And so I think that, you know, ultimately what we need to do is think about strategies for making, for example, our schools more equal, so that parents are not even in this position where making decisions about where their child is educated leads to such profound differences in outcome.
Margaret Hagerman, her book is called White Kids. Margaret, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
This final note on the way out today, with which I am going to have to beg to differ. There's a new Harris poll out on best restaurants broken down by types of food. Here comes my objection. Taco Bell was rated by the 77,000 participants in this Harris poll as the best Mexican restaurant. which simply isn't true. The best Mexican restaurant is about 2 miles from my house, and no, I'm not going to tell you which restaurant it is. Also, just to further stir the pot, the Harris Poll also ranked Five Guys Burgers and Fries as the best burger restaurant. No opinion on that one. Kohl's as the best department store. Also no opinion. Courtyard Marriott as best upscale hotel. I vote no, but okay. All right, we got to go. Dow Industrial's up 27 points today, about a 10th percent. NASDAQ down 18, 2/10 percent. S&P 500 basically flatty, flat, flat. Sarah Bergeri, that's basically flat. Sarah Bergeri, Jake Gorski, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Dan Powell, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.